This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Des Bishop Podcast, which should really change its name to the I'm Sorry Podcast, because too often lately I have begun my podcast by apologizing to you guys for not updating more regularly. So I do apologize for that. However, I did promise that when I got to the Melbourne International Comedy Festival, there would be some regular posts. Perhaps we'll get back to my August level of putting up podcasts when, we were doing 2 a week back in those days. Anyway, long story short, we begin again. Regular access to comedians here at the Comedy Festival. And who better to start with than Ireland's own Dara O'Brien, one of the gods of Irish comedy. And he's in very good form. Very happy to be back in Melbourne. First time gigging in Australia for 16 years. So I caught him at a nice time up in his beautiful hotel room at the top of the Grand Hyatt on Collins Street in the CBD of Melbourne. And we chatted about some nostalgia, some general crack. A nice, honest story, actually, about a sort of a darker time in Dara's comedy career, which I didn't realize it had got that sort of dark for him right before the brightness of his incredible success in the UK. He had pondered chucking it in, which was interesting. And I asked him some stuff about my own desire to go back and learn maths, because I had a theory about how it might help me. I chatted to him about that and science. And to be honest, Dara's a great man for the chats. So there's no point in even trying to give you a précis of what went down. I'll rather just introduce the man and his wonderful wit and his great turn of phrase and his incredible pace of speaking. Ladies and gentlemen, Dara O'Brien. Yeah, so just chat away there and I'll just make sure that your levels
are... No problem. 1, 2, 1, 2. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm a little hungover.
Oh, you're hungover.
Yeah, I am. And like this... It's foolish, really, because it wasn't like an epic night. I should choose my night.
You should
more.
Pick it well.
Yeah, and I didn't. I went for it because I'm back in Melbourne, and the whole point of being in Melbourne used to be, because Melbourne was not Edinburgh. It was a fun month.
Yeah, it was meant to be fun. Yeah,
yeah, and so you go to there's a bar called the Hi-Fi Bar, and everyone there. And my memory is, this is just my memory from 16 years ago, is there was one bar, and we all went there. Every single night, we were all there. And so I went back to this one because this is still the same place. It was the Hi-Fi Bar 16 years ago. Now it's whatever it's called now. But it's the same place.
Yeah, but it's still called the Hi-Fi to us, even though it's called Jack Watts or something.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Or Max Wall or something.
And
then I... there's about 20 people there. And I'm chasing a... It's like Oisín coming back from Chernanog. I'm chasing a thing that isn't there anymore. And I should let it go. I'm a 45. I'm also dead. Which is exciting.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. That I did. Somebody sent me that this morning. Having no idea that I was going to be chatting to you today. I can't figure that out. So you obviously some guy just made up a death.
Presumably there was a bot. And there was something, which is one of the more interesting responses. That this is just, what's interesting about this is not your death, but how well written, sort of well written this artificially created story was about how it died. Apart from the bits that they were driving home from a showbiz. which was
I didn't read it in that much detail. Yeah. No, driving home from a showbiz.
Driving home from a showbiz, and the car plummeted into a ravine.
On Patrick
Street in Dublin, and which has been used to the people of Dublin, that there's a ravine. There's not even a major... Patrick Street's much of a Cork thing, to be honest. It's a very small street in Dublin. But it's a ravine, one of those famous ravines we have in Dublin.
Underground rivers. I was trying to think, are they smarter than they seem? That it's one of those underground rivers that goes into the Liffey underground.
I don't think they've talked to it. And there's a generic picture of a smashed up car that appears.
I saw that twice.
Yeah, and you're going, wow. And it's in a grassy area, like, and you're going, there's no, where is it?
Well, it's funny because the person that sent it to me knew that you were over here because they knew that I was chatting to you. And they were like, no, I told my friends, it can't be him. He's in Australia. They were taking it seriously. He couldn't have crashed in Patrick Street last night. He was in Australia.
But it's you know, giving me some, you know, some proper time for reflection. Yeah, I'm going, is this how I want to be remembered? And yeah, it's fine.
So here we are in Melbourne, the Ambassador Suite. It's pretty fancy.
It is, you know, but I'm only here. I'm on a very concentrated. So all of your... The rest of you, how you're working 27 days to basically sell the same number of tickets as I'm doing, but I'm doing it in a burst.
Amen, brother. I am on your pit. The only problem is I enjoy the time.
Because I'm
not married and I don't have
children. Yeah, that's the thing.
So I don't have anything anchoring me down.
I'll really ache when I have to leave, though. I mean, like, even though it'll be great because I'll be going home, albeit via Perth, which I'm not sure about, probably be very much quieter.
Oh, yeah, but it's lovely, though.
Oh, great. Okay, cool. Well, it might be...
And it's very intense with the Irish.
Yeah, I've already been invited to do some sort of come to some Irish society thing on one of the nights. And
yeah, there's a lot of that going down.
So I sidestepped it a little bit because I found that a bit strange. I mean, the Irish here, my God, Sydney was just...
Yes, I wanted to... That's what I was going to ask you about. Like,
tripping
how do you,
over Irish people. It's
they're everywhere. They are. And all the lollipop ladies are Irish girls.
Yeah, I heard that. I didn't see it, but I heard you're the second person to say that.
Yeah, well, you know how I know, because you probably weren't up. But because I wake up early and go for a jog, when I'm in Sydney especially, I'll be like jogging, like nobody on the street except for these lollipop ladies. And then they'll be like, oh my God, this bishop! Some kid gets hit by a car because the lollipop lady getting distracted, you know?
What's your story? Yeah, I heard that a lot. That's really funny. No, there's a line in the show which is almost just a throw to the Irish, which is where I go, listen, it's great to be over here doing a short tour and doing two nights in Sydney and two nights in Melbourne, and then I've got to pick fruit for 88 days. Then I'm going to go to Perth. Right, and that really rings, because there's a longer version which I go, for those who don't know, it's a law now that if you do your first year here, grand, but to do the second year, you have to do 88 days of working on a farm somewhere. And I know that all Irish people have, when told this, have kind of leaned into whoever the Australian official is and gone, yeah, I know who that's meant for. And you say immigrant, I know who you mean, who should be doing this, right? But like, no, that's not us though, is it? That's not, you know.
Well, you used to be able to pay them off, you know?
Oh, was it?
Yeah, you used to be able to pay a farm, like basically a farmer would take a bit of money and then write you in and you could stay, but they cracked down on that. Because in my early years of coming to Australia, you know, because it was real intense back in those days with the Irish. So like, I had a lot of that stuff, you know, like all the immigration stuff. But the Irish filled me in on all the tricks.
That's hilarious.
And going de facto on other people's visas. And,
yeah.
You know, so like, you know, you can go de facto.
No, what's the... Sorry, what's...
So de facto is like, say we're in a relationship. I'm a woman, you're a man. Mm-hmm. And you have a visa.
The only relationship allowed in Australia.
I can go de facto on your visa, even though we're not married. So like, I'm your de facto wife.
But it's a very like common law. Like, oh, yeah, so it's not actually a state.
Yeah, but for visa purposes, it's 100% fine. They can then work.
Ah, okay.
But it's an amazing scenario because then the de facto person, their time in Australia is reliant on the other person. So you can't fuck around. that's a tight space to be in a relationship.
Wow, that is,
it's
isn't
like
it?
You better fucking do the dishes or you're going right back to fucking... You're going right back to 2009 Ireland. You know? Yeah. Wouldn't be such a problem nowadays.
Wow, that is funny. The place is looking a bit of a mess at the moment, actually. Mary, I can't help noticing. If I were you, I'd give that one more run around to the Hoover.
So are you finding that you're getting the other people at the shows?
Yeah, it's working out, because I mean, there is and this is something I think you've had as well at times, and it's nicer when you travel to actually meet the people from the country. And while we appreciate the enthusiasm of the Irish, you sort of, if it's all Irish, then it just becomes this weird transplanted gig. But it's kind of been one third Australian, one third British. Because
yes, I was going to say, ask you, do you get them as well?
Yeah. One third British, one third Irish, and one third Australian.
So it's like doing a gig in Dubai.
Yeah, it's one of those big expat gigs, to us with it. But so at least able to do some stuff about Australia, and we're interesting. Front row people, all Australian. Which has been good.
Which is good for you.
So anyone I've spoken to and actually defined the gig around, as it were, they've all been local.
You never got jammed up, did you? Like with an Australian place or just...
No, it hasn't happened yet. I think I know just about enough about it, and I haven't accidentally... Oh, Launceston, I think I got wrong yesterday, rather than Hobart and some sort of mess up. But I went, if you're ever in Launceston, and there's, you know, I wrote it out. But they've been generous about giving me stuff. But like, it was weird. It was the last night, the first night in was the best, you know, because Sydney was, the first night was a guy who worked in IT, another guy who worked in IT, an anaesthetist, his partner, also
anaesthetist,
which is quite good.
Is that common?
No, very rare. And so I did loads about anaesthetists. And then who are you here? Oh, you're a partner. What do you do? I'm also an anaesthetist. And you're going, I feel I've done anaesthetist now. And so are you going, oh God. And then the last woman was was one of those jobs that has eight different words in the title and no one knows what it means and they can't explain. It's come sort of a, you know, kind of a mid-level management learning coordinator for... No one knew what it was. One of those kind of corporate-y jobs that just is impossible to explain. Whereas last night, first guy said, what do you do? And he said, really? And I was going, oh God. And he said,
yeah. Oh no.
He said, I'm a grave digger. Oh. And he genuinely was a
good one.
Really good one. And his wife is there, who's a debt collector. And you're going, you're the most emo couple I've ever met. And it was all jokes about when they, on your first day there, did they move the pegs in closer to make the grave too small? That when you took the grave, you know, the coffin wouldn't go down. Or did they ever take the ladder out when you're all the way down? Like, silly
questions
things
you've always wanted to
always
ask.
Always wanted to ask, yeah.
Because it's a job that still exists. It's not like a job, you still have to dig the hole.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, how often do you find a sand with the skull in your hand going, alas, poor Yorick. And then, you know, there was a woman who's I'm a media producer, but it turned out she'd made a female friendly pornography. So was easy to talk about.
That's on the up now.
Well, listen, I can only applaud it. And then a guy at the end who was a tour guide for a tram museum in Launceston in Tasmania that only has four trams. And he
took one of them for the museum.
You know, they used to have 29 trams, and then now they've only got four. So how they winnowed down their number of trams, and it was just the little museum that could. And you know, she'd visit, and it won't take long. You'll be there for doing it. And he said, "Are you have your favourites?" And he says, "Well, two of them are very good." So it was just sweet. They were
and that was working. All that stuff was going
gold. It was lovely for ages, and it was great. But then we got into. There's a thing I do, and people seem to do this many times, where have you ever saved a life? And it's an audience thing where they tell me stories. And like, it was an Irish woman who said, well, I suppose I saved a guy who was in financial difficulty. And I'm going, no, this is a story about somebody, you know, we don't want...
Drowning people.
It was like you pulled him out of a pool is what I want to hear, not that I averted a suicide.
I helped him get his tracker mortgage back.
Yeah, it was like that. And I said, really? And she said, but then there was another time we went into a house and there's a dead body there. And I go, no, this is not...
Too late.
Yeah, it's just... And then another was, and some other woman talking about like essentially Munchausen's by proxy on a pet, where somebody attacked their pet. And you're going, what? Why are you telling me these stories? These are hideous stories.
I know, you want one fucking shark story.
Yeah, that's all I need. All I need.
One fucking shark
all
story.
I need is if somebody said.
So you could bang out your shark shit from 16 exactly, years ago. Yeah.
Funny you should mention that. I have a list of 16-year-old material that is originated here that I want to do here. Like the koala story, and the funny response it got in DCU from a decade and a half. That
the
has
bar
killed.
DCU before the hub.
Yeah. It was all of these things that I did. The Irish people can't learn to scuba dive. That's come out based on a holiday.
Yeah, that was a great routine.
It's a great routine. And it still works.
That's another podcast in itself. Like, the fact that we leave so many routines behind that should not be left behind.
Well, essentially, I have been doing greatest hits here, which, and the main reason for that is because I was worried that if I went out and did a show, like if I went out and did Crowd Tickler, the last one, there would be a significant number of people who've either got it on DVD by this stage or seen it online or seen the edited version on some on SBS or something like ABC. Yeah, yeah. And then you can hear the bit where it goes from off the cuff to into material that they go, oh, no, we know all this. And they're just, and you can see them, as it's happened a couple of times on these later international gigs that come later in the cycle, that I did Zurich and Geneva earlier in the year, not knowing that BBC, they all have BBC, because it's actually one of the channels available in Switzerland, and
it had
been on 3 weeks before, and I got away with it.
You did that in Moscow too, right?
I did Moscow, and Moscow was weird because they'd all because they're nerds and they'd seen everything online. Did the opening joke of whatever there was crack dealer.
You did a switcheroo or something.
I had to switch because somebody it didn't go work, and I presumed I just uncovered an interesting social difference that this joke didn't really run here. And I go, oh, how interesting! That's not funny. Why is that not funny to you? And a lovely guy raised his hand with a big smile and said, "We've seen it already. We've seen all of that show." And on stage, I had to try to remember old material.
It's hard sometimes.
Oh man, it goes. I think there's, you have space in your head for about 3 hours of stuff, I think. Like the current show and a couple of other bits, I think. And everything else just gets shunted back. So in Moscow, when I did that gig, how did I end the show? Sharks and bears. That routine was the comment. It was the end routine of that show. Thank you very much. Good night. And I'm out
of
here.
Think some of those routines stick harder because we did them more. Like we did them for longer.
The
you know?
Club stuff, I think, really. You did it in every different context. And
I miss the rhythm sometimes. Like I miss the cadence of those early bits. You know those bits that you wrote when nobody knew who you were, and you just had to go up and fucking rip it in front of these strangers.
Yeah. Stuff sometimes, that had to hit fast.
Yeah, stuff that had to hit fast. No, like, it's me, you know. No 15-minute honeymoon period.
I suppose at this point in my life, I'm looking back and around and maybe some gentle observations about
like
life.
Sort of referring back to other routines almost in a way. Like,
Like
you're kind of doing routines that require previous knowledge of stuff you've done before, this type of thing.
Yeah, so that is, it's nice to come back and just hit them with something.
But what I also find is, in a situation like you're in now, where you're going back and doing some older bits, sometimes you make them better. You're better now, or something new comes out of it, then you leave in the old bit with the new bit, and it actually becomes like a better bit. I'm actually doing one now at this show that was from 2010.
Right, okay.
Because I went back to the States. I want to talk to you, talk to me, but went back to the States. I started doing this routine again because it was just like a generic bit that you could do in a club. Then it fucking became 10 times better, so I brought it back. Nobody complains.
No. To be honest, one guy complained to me after the Geneva gig, set up a Twitter account and said, it's a pity you haven't got any new material, and then closed the Twitter account. And I said, no, going, look, I'm sorry. Genuinely, I'm sorry for that. I didn't realise you'd all seen that. And in my head, I'm still finishing off a tour of that show. But I think in future, you know, because it used to be a thing that once the DVD's out, you stop. But you kind of, that doesn't apply. How can that apply in Zurich or Basel or whatever? I think you have to be very careful about doing that. So this one has been a spread of loads of different stuff. It sounds like a greatest hits package. It's worked very well. No one's gone. I know everything here. Why are you doing
I still have to do some of my punchlines twice here. I have to do the Australian version and the Irish version.
Oh, that's interesting. I
have a very lighthearted joke just about it. It requires an area. It's not a groundbreaking joke, but I say the Australian area and the Australians laugh. Then I say the Irish area and the Irish laugh.
That's
but you can tell the difference. Irish just don't get it.
That's funny. And then, but you have to, different parts of the room laugh at the difference.
Yeah.
There is a there's a gag I had about... I have a number of jokes, weirdly, about pole dancers. And I'm not a big pole dancer person, but it's an inherently ridiculous trade on many levels. But about
a hobby for a lot of people.
Yes, well, tragically. But the women doing the poles, that's really strange. But I have a thing about the names chosen. This is the thing. And I have a joke about confectionery, choosing a confectionery-based name if you're a lap dancer is sometimes it's great and sometimes it doesn't work, like whatever. And at home, it's on the main stage, candy. Candy on the main stage. And on the second stage, Wibbly Wobbly Wonder. that's the Irish version.
It doesn't work here.
British version is, and on the second stage, Double Decker. And the Norwegian version is on the second stage, Kviklunch. which is their version of Kit Kat, the Swedish version. And on the second stage, Mums Mums, which are this kind of chocolate dumpling with the thing on top, but it looks like a boob anyway. So that's by far the most powerful one of all, Mums Mums. And here it's on the second stage, Tim Tams. And so everywhere I go, I have to go,
you have to be that comic that's like, hey, you know, here, like,
Yeah, and like, it's so hacky, but
this joke I just mentioned is a bit hacky, but it kind of sets me up for something else, you have to do thing.
The search is funnier than anything else. I mean, and Quick Lunch was particularly good because I said I told them I needed to think Quick Lunch, whatever, and I don't even know what Quick Lunch is, like, whatever. And it turned out Quick Lunch in Norway is Kit Kat, right? But they said, oh, this is incredible, it's our incredible sweet, we all love it. And the audience were, yeah, Quick Lunch. Like, and then during the break, somebody put, when I came out, loads of people had put Quick Lunches out in the head. Picked it up and said, it's just a fucking Kit Kat. What's special? Like, and then another half hour later in the show, in the middle of another routine, I went, oh wait, Quick Lunch. And they all went, yeah, that's what it means. Oh, it took me ages to get that. Yeah, Quick Lunch, that's what it is. Like, yeah.
There's the humor in it.
Yeah, so that repaid itself many, many times.
Because Kit Kat would be a fine pole dancer's name.
Yeah.
It would be absolutely fine. Oh, that's great. Yeah. So, I mean, I have a lot of things to ask you, but then we've already been chatting for 20 minutes.
Well, that's the way this should go. And that's the way it should always go. Are we reflecting on death at the point? Do you get, by the way, and as you get older, do you, not on death itself, right? And you're clearly a very fit man, you'll live to be 112.
No,
right?
I've thought about death.
Yeah, but
I've been around death.
But showbiz death, does that encroach anybody? Do you ever go, oh, this could all...
Fear of my career falling apart?
Yeah,
of course I've thought of that.
Or just the, I finally agreed, and I'm intrigued by it, and when, if somebody would tell me when, this is just going to stop. And does it, because I don't think it is, I think it peters out, and I'm waiting for the bit.
Are you expressing your own fears through a question to me?
Yeah, I am, essentially, yeah. I had a routine in a previous show in which I tried to address it about doing the dancing thing, Strictly Come Dancing, and about how I should do Strictly.
Yeah, but I did it.
Well, yes, I know. Well, that's
so. Say that's career death.
No. I said you should do it now, and I should do it now, right? Because it will. Because I just seen the film Looper. You ever see Looper?
No.
Science fiction film where there's a time machine thing, and then your future self comes back and you have to assassinate your future self, or it's all I just see it, I'm thinking I have to do Strictly Come Dancing now because it's to stop me doing it in 20 years time.
Oh, when it looks like you're desperate.
Yes. So if you do it at the peak, do it at the actual peak of your career, because it's like, wow, what a great thing to do. Like, yeah. As opposed to, oh, look what they've wheeled out this time. Who's a tragic comic version, like the big, really old...
Well, I did it. Funnily enough, when I did it, I did have that thought. I was like, well, I've just done this show on RT. This is our, you know, I'm busy as shit. So nobody's going to be able to turn around and be like, well, he must have been desperate. He must love dancing.
Yeah.
I did have that very thought process of, yeah, I don't want people to think like, oh, fuck, this guy's desperate to get on the telly.
Yeah, no. Well, no one was presuming that, like, whatever. I do think, because you have that great thing about your American friends going, yeah, you got to do it. And your Irish friends,
you're going to make a fucking idiot of yourself. But that's absolutely true.
It is. And it's exactly our response would be to that.
Jeff Ross did it in America. That was like my kind of like, fuck it. He's a cynical bastard. If he did it, then...
Did he get fired?
No, first round. But I assumed he just took the piss, but he told me he took it seriously, but he just got voted off. But he loved it. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. No, I tell you what I wanted to ask you about, because it's something I'm very curious about for myself. You know all the math stuff you do?
Yeah.
And, you know, like, I know you have a degree in theoretical physics and all that, but just on math.
Yeah.
Right, maths.
That's okay. Don't worry. I
was shit.
I find it increasingly. It's the small minds who go, how can they say it's math if they don't know it's maths? I was just fine. All right. We've all spotted that now.
Well, I was terrible at maths. Russ.
Yeah.
And like painstakingly so. Like hated it.
Okay.
I didn't have to repeat maths in my leaving. I found out 2 months into my repeat leaving cert year. I found out that my pass that I already hadn't passed maths would count as the requirement for having
to get the thing, yeah.
And I nearly had like a dance in the fucking aisle when I found out that I no longer had to do math. Like, for the rest of my life, I was done.
Yeah.
And in later years, I kind of regret that. I feel like I must have been taught badly. I can't be that sort of
numerically. No, you're a smart guy. You should be
Yeah, I know, yeah. And then I did the languages stuff.
Yeah.
never liked languages at school. Turned out to be quite good at languages. Like, do you think I was just taught badly?
Possibly, yeah. I mean, and or also the context in which it's taught. I think people, obviously it's a subject and it's a school subject. And people, Irish is a good parallel for this. Irish, I did Irish because as a language, as a living language, and around me, and was able therefore to know, oh God, Peg is dull, or that poetry is dull, but not that the entire language is therefore dull. So because we're discussing how dull it is in the language, because I went to an all Irish school, right? You then went back and did Irish as something that you would speak in, you know, and for those shows, like whatever, and proved to be, I presume, a much better experience.
Well, yeah, it's the way you should always learn a language.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway.
Yeah. But people see it as a subject. I think it maths as well, because there's a lot of doing things over and over and over and over again, and not seeing the purpose of it and the point of it. You know, it's somewhat difficult to kind of just tell people, because there's always a move that we can, if we just say the right combination of words, people will realize how fun it is. And I don't think it's necessarily always going to be fun for people. I think there are people for whom it is.
Like, it is fucking hard.
It is hard, yeah. And by the way, it continues being stupidly hard. I went to university with how hard it got. It gets ludicrously, I emerge, oh God, got away with that, I never do that again, but wow, that just gets really rare.
Yeah, but then you brought it back as fucking entertainment.
Was that
for you more of an exercise or a genuine thought that you could make
it? No, honestly, it took me about 15 years to rediscover the passion I had for it as a teenager. The university bet it out of me, because it became a method and method and method and method, and it wasn't about the really interesting sexy results. Like when you do any science broadcasting, it is sexy result, sexy result, sexy result. Look at this planet that does this, and the planet spins, or it spins one way, but the gas spins one way, and the stars spin a different way. And what we're not showing it is the incredibly painstaking way that people had to go to find out how there's the red shift in this way, the blue shift that way, and the different things, it's spectrographic analysis of that, and all the stuff that takes to get to the sexy result. So when you go to university to study this stuff, your head filled with sexy results, they're actually training you for a career in discovering this stuff, reasonably enough. And so a lot of the joy gets bet out of it, particularly when you have this other option of running off to the debating societies. And
yeah, I actually, funnily enough, in my quick Google sconce, I noticed that you had said that sort of like second year in college, you sort of lost your focus.
Yeah, hugely. I did a thing in UCD recently. They brought me back to have a talk or something like that, an alumni thing. And I said, when I came to UCD, I had a bright academic career behind me. And it was very much the case that I came in there, did well in first year, and then discovered this, essentially, this life, and that was it, done. So, when I left, the head of the department, I came in to say goodbye to him, and to confirm to him, I won't be doing a master's place. And he was like, I don't think you really needed to drop by. Tell me that. I think we got that. He said, we'll miss you. He said, you had a tremendous flair in your mathematics, he said.
He could see something in your mathematics.
There we go. And I said, right. And I said, oh, and I walked out. And then the door closed behind me and he was, it might not have been meant as a compliment. He was like, we were looking for rigor, but you gave us flair. You gave us any idea.
What is flair in mathematics?
I think I was lashing any idea onto the page. I was just crazily flinging things around. There was at one stage a series of equations called the Frenet-Serre equations it's a curvature of it on the surface. It's not important, Dara, that I tell what exactly they are. It's the funny ones I can look them up anyway. And I genuinely, in the exam, idly thought of answering the question in French, just to make it. So I thought it'd be a fun thing to do.
That'd be showing off, Dara.
Yeah, but actually, no, because there's very few words needed. All you have to, because most of it says that, and you just have to say therefore, thus, whatever. And I thought I could have bluffed those ones. Voici les équations de Frenet-Serre, and I would have done it all through that. And I should have done it. One of the things that I really just should have done that.
That would have showed up on a show later on.
Yeah.
I would have shown up on a PowerPoint.
But you know, it would have been, quietly, it would have laid a thing that years later, not knowing which way my career was going to go, that years later the department would have gone, well, we had him here. Do you know he answered a question in French? And they even back in college.
He was a genius.
You know, it's like now I realize that you could have, for those biographies later where they went, already in college, his desire to play with the form.
History Channel documentary about your life.
And there's an interview with a dusty maths professor going, oh, we couldn't get him to do the maths, but oh, the time. We all still speak of the time he answered the question in French, but I didn't do it.
After the break, Dara Does Family Affair.
Oh, that's not. Oh my lord! Somebody shouted Echo Island at me in the Sydney Opera House.
Oh really?
Yeah. I mean, it's like absolute career high point of my life. I'm playing the Sydney Opera House. It's sold out for two nights. It's rammed. It's going great. And somebody shouts Echo Island at me, and you're going.
And you shout back. How old are your kids now?
Yeah, exactly.
That's a fucking long time ago. Oh, God. Well, actually, I'm going to come back to that. I don't want to digress because let me just ask you my second thing about Matt.
Yeah, yeah.
So I remember AV Nihuluan. You know AV, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So she's kind of like a champion for the cause of making Matt's fun.
STEM.
Yeah. So. I was listening to her and I was like, fuck, that would be interesting. Almost like the Irish language thing to kind of go back and think shit at maths. No, I never went through it, but I had this thought that maybe if I figured out maths, I could actually like find a new way of writing jokes. Do you find that there's any mathematics in joke writing?
I certainly find, a lot of routines are structured like arguments, like a progression of arguments, like you do in a proof, for example, that you'd and there's certain logical devices that you use in mathematics that we naturally use. Excuse me, what happened there? We naturally use in writing comedy. There's one called reducto ad absurdum, where you have you want to prove a basic principle, so you presume the opposite. And then you follow through, presuming the opposite, until you reach a point where, you know, 1 = 2, and you go, well, therefore, listen, because of that, therefore, the presumption was wrong, and therefore, the thing
so it's like every Bill Burr routine.
Listen.
Incredibly sexist thing.
Yeah.
Let me explain.
Exactly. we constantly do a thing where we take things to their logical extremes. We do it all the time. Oh, I see. Such and such said this. Well, if that was the case.
If that was the case.
Then,
right. Yeah.
And that is the exact same structure as you do a lot of in an argument in mathematics. But the only thing is, I mean, I can do that retrospectively. It doesn't help coming up with stuff.
Yeah. So you never sit down and go, you know, like whatever, some simple mathematical way of looking at a thing and saying, you know, X equals Y, therefore this is funny. Yeah.
I don't know if comedy works. Mathematics and theoretical physics tend to be reductive. Strip a system down to its bare workings, and then to mathematics of its bare workings, where the vectors are and all the things. I don't think that often in comedy reductive works. I think you can strip away too many things, and the context is everything. And
because I always thought like somebody like Dimitri Martin's jokes were somewhat mathematical.
Very precise.
Very precise. Yeah.
But listen, I'm not precise on stage.
But it's funny. Dara does not use what you would consider to be somewhat mathematical.
Yeah,
techniques.
I certainly don't. Like I don't go there with a clipboard and deliver the perfectly honed lines.
This is not a criticism. I was more of a curiosity of my own, you know, sense of like if I could get that part of my brain working. Like I always felt like it just never got going.
Now maybe. Well, yeah, it is, and it's an interesting thing to have.
I don't even know if that scientifically makes sense.
But I think there's two separate things here. There's maths and there's actual science. And maths is great. I love it. But it bears no relation all the time to if you meet a working scientist. What they do is a thing that you, when you're doing maths, you never do, which is they set up a thing and they measure it 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 50,000 times. They find things and they measure it over and over again painstakingly, and then they find a statistical correlation between what they've measured and what they were looking for, all of which has nothing to do with what I did on a blackboard, which was here's an argument and a puzzle. And but the actual stuff of how science works, it's pouring over things and looking at evidence after evidence after evidence after evidence after evidence. There's none of that in mathematics. That's not the way. It's a different thing entirely. So when I did some like Stargazing Live, I arrived in with this line on my CV of I did a degree in science, but it was of no value when I met people who actively worked in. It would be great if I met other mathematicians or other theoretical people, but no, people who actually take photographs of the sky and see what dot moves slightly over the course of a year and look, oh my God, we think that's a very distant comet or whatever. That is, you actually have to do that over and over and over again and do all the things. There are people who study cells on plates and then slowly grow them and try them again and again and grow them again. That has nothing to do with what I do. I had to actually learn what a science job really involves, and it didn't involve the kind of stuff I was doing. It's kind of
weird. So you're sort of, all of a sudden, you're in the middle of this world that seems to be like exploding, like the sexiness of science.
Yeah.
which I think is great.
Well, see, I think we've gone on a cycle of it. When digital media started, all the sexiness of science stuff started, and all these people like Ben Goldacre and Brian Cox and all these people suddenly emerged into public life, and it was a rejection of all the nonsense because we all found each other and we could express all these, and there's a big community of scientists, and suddenly Twitter really worked for us. And now we've in turn been drowned out by another wave of nonsense and nonsense.
Yeah, well, that's what I wanted. That's what I was leading to.
It's really strange because it was.
But
was
I don't think
you've
been drowned out. I just think they've both risen together.
Possibly, but I think we had a moment where it was, yay, this is great, and we should be all looking at these. This is how we should be leading our lives, and we should have more evidence and more argument and all that. And that has now, that's not as dominant a philosophy on social media. Turns out, we thought it worked really well for us. It works really well for fake death news stories. And
Nutribabble.
Yeah.
And anti-vax.
Yeah, all that stuff.
Yeah.
140 characters, it turns out, is very good for talking shit as well.
Yeah, so what I was thinking about was, so you're part of the Brian Cox world,
which is
great because it's just informative and entertaining, and I think people get a lot out of it, you know?
Yeah, I hope so.
But do you also feel an obligation to take on the other side that's rising up? Or do you feel like it's not worth the hassle?
No, do you know what? I did when it was... I've done the routines about anti-vax, and I've done the routines about... for a while, it was the silly stuff, the psychics and the astrologers, and we've done that.
And that great routine about a massage that you had years ago. I don't even know if you remember it.
You had this great
routine about the massage. I think it was in the left lot, so it's probably too long ago. But it was all this like, yeah, you're let everything go. And it's like the more she talked, the more unrelaxed.
She stood behind me. It was in Killarney. And she had done a very good massage, and then she held my head. And she just inhaled and exhaled. And I wanted to laugh, and I could feel myself tensing as I tried to stop myself laughing. I could feel tension returning to my body as I tried to control myself from the fits of giggles I wanted to have. And I left as knotted as I'd arrived because the woman had just held my skull, going, "Oh, there we go, and we'll move, we're just going to bring the energy." And I'm going, "You were doing great, pet. When it was just kneading muscles, you nailed that. But this sudden..."
Over me,
and I was trying not to even smile. And
but then,
just,
if you challenged her, she would have said, "Well, you should have laughed. That's your body trying."
Oh God!
I would be laughing in your face. But anyway, so you're saying you were doing the anti-vax.
Really, my favorite massage joke that never really worked was I feel sorry for people who genuinely are masseuses, because it's the only trade in medicine of all the related medical fields that has a sexy version of it that people can access. Like, no one ever goes to the dentist and the dentist takes off their top and you go, no. Oh no, I just wanted a normal dentist. This is really embarrassing.
Well, I guess a prostate check would be the other one.
No one does. Yeah, prostate charts. I'll do this topless because that'll make us both feel better about this. No one goes, "Oh no!" And I just love the phrase. No, I didn't. I wasn't looking for a sexy dentist. I genuinely have a pain in my teeth. I did walk into a massage place in Australia when I was here 15, 16, these mythical 15, 16 years ago. Because I went into somewhere and I twanged my back, which often happens to me, big man. And I twanged my back and I said, "Oh, I need a. Is there somewhere to do a massage?" Presuming that they would know what I mean. And the young woman said, directly above here. But you have to go around the back. So I walk around the back, and this is Glenelg or somewhere like that, just outside Adelaide. And I went up the steps like the most naive kid in the world. Went in and said, "Oh, I'm looking for a massage. What do you do?" And she said, "Well, ordinary massage is this and fantasy massage is that." And I'm going, "What is fantasy massage like?" And it was like, "Oh, I don't think this is what I thought it was." And I genuinely have a bad back. And she's going, "Oh, okay, well, yeah." And I think she was actually slightly hurt, going, "Well, we do actually also, it is actually also a massage. We probably could, just happens that.
We can fix your back."
Yeah, we'll do that. We'll get the back done.
Turns out it was your wallet and your backpack.
Yeah. Oh, yes, God.
Sorry, I have too much of a stupid memory. I got a terrible back. Oh, a masseuse in Kilkenny told me it's your wallet.
No, a chiropractor told me on the 23rd session. This is one of the reasons. Chiropractic is nonsense. And I did 23 sessions. Keep going back to this guy in London. And on the 23rd, I said, and I'm getting angry going, "This is nothing is improving my back, right?" And then I picked up and I put my wallet, paid him again. I put the wallet into the pocket and he said, "Where are you putting your wallet?" I said, "Well, it's in my back pocket." He said, "And do you sit?" Yeah, I said, "Oh, no, don't do that." And then I, from there on in, instantly my back pain went away, and And so you kind of go, right, well, he nonetheless, he did solve it.
And you did pay him 23 times.
23 times it took him. And he kept doing all the cricking and cracking and all this lewd.
It's worth it for the cracks.
Ah, stop it. It's nonsense. But anyway, yes, stop remembering things. Sorry. Yes.
It's just too much fun, you know, the stupid thing. I always remember because anytime I like every now and then I go, I should take my wallet out of my back pocket because Tara said it helped his back. It's just like a stupid thing that sticks in your memory.
Yeah, it's a wedge. You're sitting on a wedge, and like one side was lifted up.
Yeah,
and
lifted
wasn't.
Up.
Like yeah, it was. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, you did the routines about like anti-vax and all that.
Yeah, yeah. I feel I've touched a lot of those. What I might do in this one is I might do just about fake news and all that stuff.
Yes.
I might do that. And my death, the announcement of my death could be
a way to jump off on that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's kind of important, though, don't you think? Because we are at this crazy age where we've access to more information and more misinformation than we ever did.
Yeah, 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 absolutely. And how we filter that. That's probably the most important thing, how we learn and how we teach kids to filter. I mean, and I remember saying this about 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and it's become more relevant. I said the two subjects that everyone is a bit sort of either scornful, they don't choose to do, but would be really important to teach kids would be statistics and media. And they're not something. Statistics, obviously, you can tell evidence and you know what's a proper claim and not a proper claim. And media, so you know the sources of things and you know what to tread around topics. And I'll illustrate with that five different topics and that's a routine. Bingo, done, right? So that's the heart of the show. Or about why it's become so vicious and why we have, where's just, oh, that's interesting, I agree. I have a different system of government that I prefer, but it was lovely to meet you. Like how that's simply gone.
It is amazing. Like the discussion has disappeared.
Okay, absolutely,
it's only like confrontational debate now. There's no.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Like, you know, everything is adversarial. Everything is heightened.
Yeah, 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 yeah. And it's, I mean, they had a referendum in England about a different way of voting and alternative voting. And it was just completely, and I was just sitting there trying in the middle going, listen, it's just, this is all it is. It's like, do you want a system that accurately represents the demographics or strongly gives you a result? And that's the debate. That's what, it's a numbers, it's a mathematics thing.
Say that again. That sounds like a very nice sentence to put out there. You just said
about the different system of voting.
Said that, and then you said it's either this and a different.
We use PRSTV in Ireland, and they use first past the post in England, and basically one of those, the one we have in Ireland, accurately maps the wishes of the people. You get 30% of the vote, you get 30% of the seats, basically. If you get 45%, you get 40%, and tends to lead to low coalition governments, but it's very representative. Whereas in the English system, first past the post violently swings from one party to the other, and so therefore gives a definite result. Right. So either you like the definite result or you like the representative one and you're happy to put up a coalition. That's the debate. None of that was the debate. It was, how dare they do this? Well, how dare you do that? Like, and you're there in the middle going, you could have a genuinely interesting thing, and people could go, let me have a think about that for a second. But none of this. It was just like, oh, how much is it going to cost to do this? And this is stealing votes from this and blah, blah, blah. And it was just, oh God, you know.
I have a feeling like all debate has gone into sort of like the way people support their premiership teams.
Yeah, yeah. No,
like,
you pick a side.
Like you pick a side, and then you just have to defend that side all the
time. Well, look, it is a thing that we don't rationally do a lot of things. We do it on, like, when you get into a polling booth and you're staring at that piece of paper, you don't have a complex series of levers in your head that adds up, well, I like these for that and them for those. You go with a gut on it, and the whole point is to try to shift your gut, because people kind of do it at some level, trust the subconscious part of their brain to have sifted all the information they've seen in the last year of the campaign to find, to make a decision on their behalf, right? To go, okay, on a good level, I like this. So we don't rationally do it anyway, in many ways. But like the strange one is that really result it shows that if you argue against somebody's beliefs, they dig in harder. People very rarely change their stance in a debate, and certainly now they don't at all, because in articulating their side of the debate, it strengthens it for them. So with all these discussions, just keep polarizing things.
Yeah, but now there's less and less curation of information, so people absolutely can just go and find what they want to find.
Yeah, now of course, you can live in the world of just your that agrees with you, and never cross over.
It's discussed a lot, but it's definitely, I feel like it's adding to the heightened sense of intensity.
It's weird, but then the question is, of course, how much of this is just a Twitter thing, and is maybe Twitter is just all extreme people, and if you actually got everyone to walk out into a park and say, right, how many of you are strongly thinking this and how many strongly that way, and they all have to walk to one side, you'd probably left with the majority of people in the middle going, oh right, well, there actually is more than us, we just don't shout about it. You can't shout in the middle ground as much, like
you're not even getting those fucking choices anymore. Like even Brexit, I feel like Brexit, whatever about the crazy vote, it's not a democratic decision, Brexit, like in that, like when you use a situation like 52% of the people can decide this. Then you go, but that would be fine if in 4 years' time we were going to have another look at it, see how it works out. Yeah. But this is, it was a weird thing to have just that one-off 52%, that's it.
And that's it, yeah, I know.
Especially something that could be so affected by the flavor of the day.
Yeah, listen, and negotiations that they hadn't really hadn't taken into account, and what the stance would be of Europe, and all these other things that they literally
have
no idea.
I would have thought that referendum should have been stay in Europe, or renegotiate our position in Europe.
I know.
Because it's crazy.
Yeah, it was a complete, this could be anything. We don't know what this is we're voting for, but we're just going to go for it, and we're going to. And look, I've shifted my position, not in towards Brexit, but in terms of regarding those who vote for the 52%, away from what I think was a mistake that we all keep saying, oh, they're all racist and they're all just anti-immigrant and all that. There is a profound issue of desire for sovereignty in the British psyche, right? And they like being an island nation. It's a very defining thing in the British mentality, in a way that seems bewildering to those of us even living there. But those who are not from Britain go, I don't get. Why would you do something self-destructive just because it speaks to a profound part of yourself? But like the parallel I gingerly do is guns in America, where we look into America and go, what's with the guns, lads? This is clearly a ridiculous thing. There's a huge number of people dying every year, but yet it's a thing that you absolutely, this is a defining thing of being an American, is the right to bear arms, and that is important. There's no possible way that's ever going to be correct. So the rest of the world's going, I don't get that. I don't get why that's such a big thing for you. Similarly, sovereignty, and we're an island nation.
Yeah, and identity.
It's a huge part.
So much of this seems to be about identity, actually.
Yeah. It is.
Liberal, conservative, sort of remain.
This is who we are.
This is the person I am. Then you have to adapt that set of principles.
There was a story that will have possibly come and gone by the time this thing goes to air.
What, you mean in 3 hours?
Oh, yeah, there we go.
I'm going to put it up straight away. I haven't put one up in ages.
Is the Easter egg controversy. Have you seen the Easter egg controversy?
I saw something about this, but I didn't follow it, I saw there was something.
It's so ridiculous. The Cadbury's organized an Easter egg hunt on National Trust properties of these twee country houses all over England. And you can bring your kids on Easter weekend, and there's an Easter egg hunt. It's a really sweet thing. Right? And somebody in the Telegraph either cropped the flyer or saw one version of the flyer which didn't prominently say the word Easter, and said, oh, Cadbury's and the National Trust are removing Easter from Easter thing, and as if it's an attack on Christian values, right? And this got to Theresa May, who spoke of it in an interview and said it's absolutely ridiculous that the National Trust and Cadbury's would remove Easter from Easter celebrations. And everyone looked up the ad, and it has the word Easter massively. It's the largest word on the ad. And then there was some poor soul, and I briefly had a conversation with them in the National Trust, which is like sweet, fusty, you know, we just look after, we just open buildings up so people can walk around country houses. Like, yeah.
And so there's something to do on a Sunday.
Yeah. And like, it's, you know, some of you to drive to kill 3 hours when you're staying with your grandparents or whatever. And it was somebody in their office was panned replying to all these furious, rabid, how dare you attack the fundamental values of my Christianity, and them going, the National Trust website features the word Easter 13,000 times. That exact phrase was, and their account was just that. We are doing nothing. We have 13,000 times, like, and people were just, no, this is ridiculous, and like, are furious about this thing. And it's just this kind of nonsense. 500 million they're spending on getting, changing the colour of the passport because they had a passport imposed upon them by Europe, they said. And in fact, somebody put out, Europe don't tell you what colour the passport has to be. You can just change the colour of the passport.
Everything just gets crazy.
Yeah. But like, and we point out, the Croatians have a black passport. It's the coolest looking passport in the world. Like, they chose for black because they're a badass. And you happen to choose the purple or whatever that we have as well. So it's they're idiots are in charge now. Absolute idiots are in charge.
Yeah, well, that identity thing is huge. So let's just on identity, just because I don't want to keep you here forever. How are we doing? Look at that, 49 minutes already. Jesus, just like that.
Yeah.
I remember the time you went to the UK.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you think you were more driven by ambition or by frustration?
It's interesting. There was a comment that was in a newspaper article a couple of years after I started doing lots of telly in the UK, which said he was one of those comedians toiling in the wake of Tommy Tiernan. In the sense that, you know, I was doing okay, but Tommy was obviously the huge star. And it wasn't that I needed to beat Tommy, but Tommy was enormous. And Tommy reflected on how, you know, you can achieve that. And I'm not achieving that. And this really sort of, it's going okay here, like whatever. But like, clearly there's success to be had there, right? The only way I thought to do is I'm going to get out of this and shift into this other area. But actually also, I like traveling and I like seeing different parts of the world and all that, like whatever. And I wanted to go there and just, for the adventure of it, as much as anything else. So it wasn't specific. And there's no way, by the way, it's like, oh, damn you, Tommy, you've driven me from my country. It was actually just that he was a good contrast to go, well, listen, clearly I could be doing better, but and that's a good sign that it's not. And it took going to England and achieving its success in England to come back here. You, by the contrast, you worked it up in Ireland. Like, so the point where we're all
doing, but I remember you saying it to me one time, funnily enough, another weird memory, on Patrick's Bridge in Cork.
All right,
there was just the thing where, I mean, you said something along the lines of, and obviously things have changed since, but you said something along the lines of like, fuck, you know, I've been doing Don't Feed the Gondolas for years, like, and it didn't turn into this. You did this one fucking show. You know, it wasn't like bitter. It was friendly conversation.
No, yeah, I know.
But, you know, and then, you know, years later, you know, you were killing it in the UK. So I often wondered, was it actually the desire for more? So there was a bit of push as well as
pull. Oh, there was. Yeah, it was. I mean, like, and I think I was, you know, and it was the only time that I would say that, is there anything you sacrifice for your career? I sacrificed a couple of years of hanging out in Reynards. I could have, you know, met lots of ladies and had a fun time in Dublin, and instead I was working the circuit in England when I was about 28, 29. So that was the only time I remember going, geez, this is, you know, this, hope this worked out now, because, you know, this is, but
yeah, but yet when you look back, you know, when you look back on that time, like Don't Feed the Gondolas, for example, had to have been important for
it
the
was,
skills
was,
that you developed
did,
later
yeah,
on.
Absolutely, it did. And there were some things, I mean, there was a thing I only vaguely remember this. I had a clipboard thing that I used to do every week on one of the series where I would do write a routine. And
that
I would
was Don't Feed the Gondolas. You had a little set piece at the end.
I had a set piece in every show, like whatever. And then Brendan released a single that I got blamed for about Who's in the House, Jesus in the House. And even for years I was hearing that. So I got the credit for that as well. But I was doing, and it was good training for a thing, but Ireland is small purely in the sense of there aren't that many gigs.
Yes.
And you'd very quickly go through the gigs.
But I also feel that there was more freedom for you. Like, so you started out on Echo Island, even before you're doing comedy, right? You did Echo Island.
Yeah.
And I know we joked about the Family Affair thing, but I remember Brian Boyd fucking ripping into you in Reynards, coincidentally enough, saying that somehow you're like a traitor to the cause,
oh,
that
God
you would
sake.
Do. I'm not talking about Family Affair, whether it's good or bad is irrelevant.
Yeah, yeah.
But the fact that you would take this TV gig early on in your career,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know.
Oh, I think it was a mistake. I think it was a bad thing to do.
But
I think at the time, possibly not a bad thing to do. It felt like, oh, well, I'll give it a go anyway. But actually, it was useful in the sense that I learned in a show that's well sort of forgotten. I learned that that's not me.
But I just remember Brian Boyd talking to you as if I feel like in a way, in Ireland, especially at that time for comedians, this sense of wanting like that type of TV career was kind of stifled if you had that type of ambition. Nowadays, not so much, but I felt perhaps in the UK you had more freedom.
Well, I made a definite point though after having done the I did a tour. I remember doing an Irish tour around about the time after Family Affair and when I just moved and was playing the clubs in England, and I came back to do a tour and it was...
Oh, you were in The Ambassador.
The most dreadful... Well, I did an Ambassador gig, which is awful. And then I did a tour of... No, this was pre-Ambassador. I did a night in Vicar Street and it was in the bar on Vicar Street.
The Shelter.
The Shelter, yeah. And there were 15 people in. And I had done 3 weeks around Ireland, which that was broadly the numbers I was getting.
And this was after Don't Feed the Gallows?
It was pre-panel. It was after Don't Feed the Gondolas, after Family Affair. And because I'd done Family Affair, I had muddied what people thought they were going to get when they saw me. So it was like...
Thought they were going to get a house?
Car that they're going to get a trailer. Citroen Picasso. That was the prize I remember. But it was like Marty Whelan doing it. Too big even for that comparison. It was like Marty Morrissey. It was like some minor arty celebrity doing a night why would I go to that? People weren't going, oh look, that's the Edinburgh show he's just done, we must go and see that because he's
I think it was around that time that you were, it was in the context of that tour that you said that thing to me
exactly, because I think I did a bad small night in every town in Ireland
and that is fucking soul destroying.
Oh my god, 3 weeks of it. And then I remember getting back and was being driven around by Carl Spain and Michael Downey, both of whom were making more in every gig, and they were doing the support
because they promised them the money.
I was a guarantee for them, and then nothing was coming back out of it. And then like I did, remember doing the Stole and going in, then nobody there, did the show to 15 people, walked around to Keane's, to John B. Keane's bar, and the one of the barman said, hi Dara, how are you? And I said, what are you doing? I said, I was doing a show. He said, oh, it's a bad night, sure, the fashion show's on tonight. And like, oh, everything. I think I fell in love 3 times over the course of the 3 weeks with people who I never saw again for one evening.
Poor, vulnerable Dara.
Yeah, I was just...
vulnerable Dara, never more lovable.
And then ended up arriving back in London and dropping my suitcase at the door and going, thank God I'm home. I remember the thing, oh, that's weird.
That's a weird feeling.
Yeah, right? I'm going, but thank God I'm back in London, thank God I'm home. And I should knock this on the head. This is just not working. It has not worked. I had a conversation with Stuart Lee at almost exactly the same time backstage in the Comedy Store where he's going, I'm just going to knock it. It hasn't worked. I've tried.
Stuart Lee also.
Yeah. I've done this for 10 years, 15 years, and I'm getting, whatever, maybe 50 people into a thing, and it's just not worked. And I said, I know the feeling, like whatever. And we had a conversation about how it's not going to happen.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I reminded
him of it, and he's not happy to hear.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because he's going to be a stroppy person.
I know, he's hard. Yeah.
Yeah, and I was like, listen, don't give me this. Oh, the wrong people are coming to my shows now, and going, you were really unhappy that nobody was going to your shows, so don't come around and go, oh, but these are the people I really want to see coming to my shows, like bear me that shit.
There was a time when you just wanted people,
any warm bodies at all, you'd have been thrilled with Stuart, so don't turn around now and complain. But it was a I thought that's it. And then I did one tryout, Montreal tryout and I rocked it, and I got a really good write-up in Chortle, the website, and I got, oh, great. And I went off on holiday.
You're going to give Steve Bennett that much credit for giving you a confidence boost?
Yeah, he saved it. He's here somewhere. We should bring him
out. He's around, yeah.
Yeah.
Steve Bennett saved my career.
Yeah, but there was
four smiley faces on Chortle, with four glasses and noses on Chortle. That's just what I needed at that time.
Oh, those little smiling noses. They're all those little grouchos. Four grouchos.
Little grouchos, that's it. Yeah. Four grouchos on Chortle.
That turned it around for me. That was the most important moment. I definitely had hit a ceiling in Ireland, and I had to go. And like, then it was only after I got Mock the Week that the panel came in, and it was only after things started to move there.
He's doing well abroad, so he must be good. Listen,
exactly, entirely that. Literally, I got this festival, Melbourne. There was a commissioning editor who I will not name, who for 2 years I said I did two Melbournes and I was ready to come back for the third year. I was moving up here, doing your thing, building it up. Brilliant, it's going really, really well. I'm going back for year number three. And a guy in as head of Ireland Entertainment RT said, no, stay around. We've got a thing for you. We want you to do a thing. Stay around. Never happened. Next year, I'm going back to Melbourne. Same guy said, no, don't go to Melbourne because we're definitely doing a thing next year. 2 years in a row, lost it. And then the thread was broken and I didn't get back for 16 years. Because RT fucked me over in that way. I hate doing RT fucked me over.
I know, yeah. Because
RT would be very good.
Yeah, but that would be a weak point to theirs. I had a similar experience where I pitched this immigration thing. So it was after Join the Hood and I pitched this thing where I wanted to do, basically find a comedian from each of the main countries that were coming to Ireland. So like Poland, Nigeria, go to that country, get to know the comedian, right? Yeah. Then bring them to Ireland, right? They get to know Ireland. And then we do like a cross-cultural gig.
Yeah, yeah, that sounds
good. So like for the expats and for Irish people in Ireland. So it's like, you guys are like this, we're like this, blah, blah, blah. Just a fun way to get to know the community.
I like that, yeah. There's a load to work on there, yeah.
RTE, handshake, it's happening. Right? Commissioned. No contract, but just like, we're going to do this. No answer. Months go by, right? So, In the Name of the Father happens by chance. Mairéadh Ní Nuán on RTE goes, there's money for Seacht an na Gaeilge. You want to do this? I said, I don't want to do it like that. I want to do it like this. Long story short, it happens. In the Name of the Father gets commissioned. I'm living in Connemara.
Right.
Right? I go to the IFTAs. I was only 2 weeks into Connemara. I had to go to the IFTAs. And I meet the guy that commissioned it. And he goes, yeah, so we're ready to do that thing. I was like, mate, I'm making a TV show for your station. Now, in the meantime, since you fucking ignored me for the last 6 months. And he didn't even know that I was fucking doing that.
Okay, well, that does happen.
It's crazy.
My favorite, and again, I don't like, because, I did loads of stuff with Archie at the time. And, yeah, I have my own. I keep my gripes generally quite private.
I know, but they're just personal stories.
But like, yeah, there is, and there should be. But
pros
I just get it goes like, you
pros
know,
and cons.
Like I'm trashing the place. But there was one amazing thing happened once where I came over here, did the panels, an Australian show, did it on my first visit here, and then
that's right, I forgot about that. Yeah, that came out of here.
Was a guest on the first
that
year.
That time, 16 years ago.
Yeah.
Little did we know that this would be like the inspiration for half of our chat.
I know. Yeah. They then went and came back the following year, was a guest again, and they said, listen, come back, you're here for a month, come back and be a panelist. And I said, I'd love to do that. And I came back and was a panelist and going, this is lovely, this show, this is great. So this is how much I was into Melbourne. I had become a regular on one of the shows here, right? There's a building over there that I can see from here called Mantra, which is a kind of a service apartment. I viewed it in order thinking I might buy a flat here. I might buy an apartment here. I was loving this city, right? And then I went back and then didn't get to it again. But it was, I brought back the VHS of my appearance on the panel thing. This is great. And I said, oh, do you know what? This would work in Ireland. This would be very easy. It's perfect because it's not rounds and points and competitions. It's just the personalities involved and we can get those. And an Irish sense of humor is very similar to the Australian sense of humor. So this would work. And I went to this commissioning editor and said, I want to do this joke on the panel. And they said, no, I thought about it. And said, no. Right? And then 6 months later, he goes, what would you want to do? And I said, I want to do a show called The Panel. He said, well, have you got anything of it? Like, I said, yeah, I'll give you the VHS of the appearance I did. You can look at it and you can see how it works and then we'll see what you think, right? So I then sat in London with Seamus Cassidy, who I was working who would end up making the show with, and we're sitting there waiting for the call, wondering what's going to happen. And eventually the phone rings from this commissioning editor and he said, we all sat down and we watched the show. And look, I don't think, he says, that the Irish audience are that interested in John Howard or Australian rules football.
You got to be joking.
Nope, absolutely not joking. The then commissioning editor thought that I was going to take this thing and take the words and, I don't know, act them, repeat the topics that I want. I'm not always buying the desk, the idea of the desk and the five people, but I was buying literally verbatim this show, and then would walk. I would open the show going, "Good day, fantastic news."
Geelong's done Geelong. Well this week.
It's a big week for Collingwood. And genuinely, we're going, and like I found it, we go, no, but we wouldn't do the content. It's not that we do Irish, we talk about Irish, and they just no. It's very Australian what they're talking about. So,
oh my God! I mean, I believe you, but I would almost not believe you. It's so outlandish.
It was astonishing. I said it was astonishing. And then the two people I won't, but who said no, it was all.
About, oh yeah, no, definitely
it was all
not
about Australian things, and I don't think Irish audiences want to hear about Australian things.
Amazing.
Oh my God. And then actually, really, he left, and then another guy came in, and he said, "What do you want to do?" I said, "The panel." I said, "Oh, there you go." And it ran for 10 years.
And like, it ran whatever. For 10 years,
yeah,
man.
It was really weird. Yeah, but John, it's my favorite dreadful commission. And by the way, there are dreadful commissioning stories in the BBC as well, just in case people think it's a unique thing to RTE.
I know they do get and too much of a hard time. They
like even
do.
In the last week, I had to ring somebody in the BBC and go, "By the way, I'm on Stargazing and Robot Wars in the same week, and now you also want to put the Edge and Me travel show on the Saturday, that these things are on the Sunday." And different departments in the BBC had to go, "Oh God, are we all putting a Darabry hour
out?" Oh, BBC.
Yeah, yeah. And so they had to bump it 2 months, because otherwise it literally would have been me on it. 7 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 8 o'clock, 8 o'clock, 8 o'clock, 7 o'clock, 9 o'clock across 5 days.
Isn't that a great complaint now, Darabry?
Well, you know, listen, it is what I believe it's called a humble brag.
I was just going to say, there's a humble brag if I have heard one, man.
Oh, you have to, the greatest problem I have, Des, is managing my popularity.
Managing the amount of time that I'm on the BBC.
It's spending people's
and
interest.
My throwaway shows on Dave.
Yeah. That's
my Dave repeats. How do I manage my Dave repeats, man?
Oh, I have a huge graph at home, like a big schedule of how many times can the public bear to see Dara.
I mean, I was going to ask you a bit more about Ireland, but I mean, like, I don't know because I don't live in the UK, but I still feel like you're more of an Irish hero than you would be like to the British people.
It's interesting. There's an innate thing that like the shows are written obviously in London. I sit in London, and the advantage of that is that it strips away any of the locals. So I'm so far out of Ireland that I'm not unlikely to go out and go, what did you not understand when I said ghee there a second ago, whatever. But it is a particular pleasure to come back into Ireland for the runs in Vicar Street and pepper with stuff.
Flesh them up a bit.
Yeah. And know that when you say it, you all get this. You're all going to get like they and there was a particular line that for about 10 minutes there was a thing about Rosanna Davidson and how she'd written her book about gluten.
Gluten,
right? And I had a thing, and I the heart of it was me going, oh sure, she was a right munter till she gave up the gluten. I mean, when she won the Miss World, oh she was a pig when she won that, but she knocked the gluten on the head, and now she's looking very well, right? And I said, it's like me writing a book called Eat Yourself Tall, you know. Just not happening, right? But it started with me just going, gluten, oh Jesus, you can't go, the gluten is everywhere. Like, and it just, it was like everyone was having to be talking about that one thing. And for a week, that joke was enormously funny because and when everyone's talking about something in Ireland, everyone is talking about the one thing.
I know, but funnily enough, I had a little Rosanna Davidson joke also, and then I couldn't find the British nor American nor Australian Rosanna Davidson.
There isn't one
to do that, you know, to... I couldn't find
There are things that occur in Ireland that don't have a direct parallel. I keep them as a thing that was just beautiful to do. You know? Just
like, nothing. Yeah, there's something more. The Irish just appreciate it more.
But there is something. I you know the whole you had to be there thing that I have about moments in a show. But there's also some that I probably the jokes I love most is the ones that just had a moment. And we're really good in that moment. Like, I mean, there's and really worked. I mean, there's one I'm opening with here about the Sydney licensing laws that you're not allowed to go into anywhere after 1:30 in the morning. The pub can carry on serving the people who are inside, but you can't go in because they want to stop people moving around from bars to bars. It's called the lockout laws, right? And I was in Sydney last Saturday night. This is how specific this joke was. I said I was joking, and I genuinely tried to get into a place at 1:35 to 2, and the guy said no, you can't come in. And I'm there going, come on, I'm sure that's more of an advisory thing than an actual rule, right? And the guy said, no, there's no getting in, you can't come in, right?
Well, I wouldn't have left the last place.
Yeah, I know. You told me that. I presumed it was a thing, right? And then I said, so I left, and then I waited till 2 o'clock when the clocks went back, and then I went back again. And the clocks at 2 o'clock go back to 1 o'clock, yes. So I returned. And this week, that joke is killing it because everyone is really recent. It's very, very new. It's exact. And then I arrive back and go, yeah, I think it's now 1 o'clock. So I'd like to go into the pub, please. So that joke will work for these five gigs only. And I will never get, and like every night, Massive round of applause.
Yeah, just a moment.
It's just a beautiful moment, and the thing is, and it's gone, and that's, and they're lovely. Those ones that just, and then in 10 years time, I'll sort of vaguely remember going, oh, yeah, that was a nice thing, but then they're gone.
Yeah. Right, this is my last question.
Go on.
You give me so much time. The British education system is not bad.
The British education system excels in excellence, but may not do much in terms of the, is good for the middle ground.
So, will you teach your own children why Ireland is not part of the United Kingdom? Because they won't learn it in school.
They're sort of Irishy, and sort of, I'm not doing the plastic paddy thing with them, but they nonetheless were, I was the Grand Marshal of the London Parade, and they came along, and for a part, my daughter skipped into the front of it, like whatever. But I try to not to do, you know, you're my family, you look at my children. Like,
kind of, I know, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, they're aware of it. I don't think they're aware of the nuances, but certainly the boy isn't, because it's not about Pokemon, so he couldn't give a damn about international relations. I'll bring them up to speed with it, all right, but I will.
It's half joking because it's so interesting how it's kind of ignored.
But listen, their thing is Brexit at the moment. They've no idea. They're more stressed about Gibraltar than noticing anything that's going on in Northern Ireland. It's insane. They've no idea what's going on. I don't think they'll be strong fighters for the cause, because it's they're different
like
culture.
Irish America. Yeah. In Irish America, we were obsessed.
Yeah. That's not a thing. I'll see as they get out how. But I will be there as a corrective, as an information source.
But
they're like, there's not a lot of Wolf Tones music in the house. That's how as it is. Yeah. So.
Because I guess like. You're letting them have the freedom to just be whatever they want. We were raised very Irish. American, but our identity was a thing. But I think that's more of an American thing.
Yeah, there is an element of in America, you're something American.
It's not as much of a thing in the UK.
It certainly isn't. No, and the other thing is that both your parents are Irish.
Yeah, well, my mother was Irish American, actually.
Oh, right. Okay, born in New York.
But it was a strong hold on in our house.
Yeah, it very expressly.
And you could say it was class. Whatever, upper working class, maybe lower middle class, whatever. It's not important. Yeah. But across the class spectrum of the United States, Irish families held on to their Irishness.
Yeah.
Like my mother worked for a law firm, O'Dwyer & Bernstein. They were highly educated lawyers. All of their kids were mega Irish.
Yeah.
And slightly supportive of the cause. It was cross all socioeconomic backgrounds that the Irish held on.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a thing for you guys.
No, it's not. In London, it's not, because you're too close to it, and it's too. And also, my wife is English, so there isn't a kind of a supporting kind of a.
A supporting member of the cast.
Yeah, it's not like, and there's genuinely going, why would we? What's so dramatic, special about. Touche, good point. So that was the line I had always in the show, the Irish education system is the greatest education system in the world. And my wife would go, I am a doctor, and you are a comedian. Whose education system exactly should we be applauding here? But what intrigues me about the Irish thing is because obviously it's for a whole other reasons there. There isn't that drive in Britain to be the Irish community doesn't cling to itself as closely, and nor does the Italian community, nor does the thing. And obviously it gets very modern versions of Irish people, very modern versions of Italian people or French people. I mean, it's not funny when you see Italian Americans go to Italy, and there's no relation between the Italian American experience and modern Italy. There's zero. And they're like, what? And I presume the same happens. We put on more of a show. I think the Irish put on more of a show for Irish Americans than Italians bother for Italian Americans.
Yeah.
I think. And so it is the thing. I thought this was and I know it's always been the case, but this particular Trump visit at Paddy's Day was a point where we have just got to give up on America and what they think we are, and let them, and stop trying to even bother trying to correct them about this, because we're gone. We've lost America now. The shoddy pint of Guinness, Paul Ryan holding up, and
amount of Irish Americans around Trump, actually.
There is astonishing. I mean, it's depressing. Flynn's and Conway's and Ryan's and these things, and dreadful individuals. But and then the
Her married name, but her maiden, Conway's maiden name is she's Irish American.
Oh, right, okay. She's something, what was she before?
I can't remember, but
I read a profile piece on her, doesn't she? But there was a. The bit where Ryan stood up and said, our president, he used to go and play golf, and now he owns golf clubs, which pretty much makes you royalty in Ireland. And I could see people going, No.
No.
You
know, not at all. Winning in All-Ireland does, you fucking prick.
The things that actually do. But no, I can't name anyone who owns a golf club.
Yeah.
I can't name even
like
the
fucking
people.
Fucking McManus, JP McManus.
Yeah, but that's not, like, the horse racing.
What makes you royalty in Ireland is paying your taxes in Malta.
Yeah.
That's what fucking makes you...
But anyway. and then they ran the compilation of photographs of the successful video of that, like with bagpipe music playing Amazing Grace over it, like, and you're going, oh, you died in Scotland. We're like, this is,
I know, it's terrible.
And so I think we've just lost them. And part of it is that Dipton Aspect thing of like you it's your fault essentially, and your parents' fault.
I mean, I take responsibility for everything.
But the Irish that it became very very solid and very specific version of Irishness that has drifted so. Almost, I think, like unbridgeably far from.
Yeah, it's almost an Irish American export, actually.
Yeah, and I think there's a different national, which Irish Americanism has no relation to it, like whatever. And unfortunately, I made the point of trying to say this to the one time I met Conan O'Brien when he was over. Do we have that thing with Conan O'Brien?
I was invited and I couldn't go. Yeah, that was the thing in the ambassador's house or whatever.
Yeah. And it was a delightful thing, but I was talking about this, like whatever. And he was looking at me going, I don't get what you're talking about, like whatever. And say, they don't see that at all. But they feel they're reaching out to something, and I had to rein it back in and go, but it's delightful that you're here and all the thing, because I didn't want to make some big point about, lads, you have no idea. You've this weird image of the place, like the, and he was the wrong person to say it to, and I've never
been on Conan as a result.
Exactly. But I actually was, I thought, I'm being rude here, and I've got to bring this back
in.
They don't know that.
He doesn't need to know either.
Of course not. I was being a bad host at that point. And in a kind of a.
It's like telling an essential oil specialist that.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's all bullshit.
It's all on you know that, don't you? You know this is not bullshit.
Right?
Yeah. Like, if it's essential, then why is it not already in there? Okay, I seem to be surviving, so therefore not that essential.
The word essential is a bit strong.
Yeah, you're leaning too heavily on essential. There, So but it's weird, the Irish thing, and it's strange here, because I think it's a young Irish people coming to the show. So we did a show here. Sorry, I'll tell you the story.
No, you can keep talking. I'm feeling bad for you because it's nearly 1:30.
Oh my lord. Okay, great. I have a whole day stretching ahead of me. We did first when we did this trip back. There was also add-on gigs they did in Sydney, but it wasn't in Sydney itself. It was a place called Parramatta, which is like
outside the city.
Yeah, outside the city. Like, and so there's a theatre there, and you take a boat to it, which is lovely. And we take the boat down to it, and we get there in the evening, and we do Best of Irish, one of these things, and it had been marketed to the wrong people in Sydney. It was marketed to the lads who've been here for 50 years, and there was Irish dancers. They asked, can we put some, we have an Irish dancing troupe, can they come on and do Irish dancing? And so, okay. And so the show started with whoever's hosting it, Brendan Dempsey, going, oh, but first, the girls of the St. Bridget's Irish dancing troupe, and they all came out and they did, like, very traditional, not even river dance, but a real traditional thing, and the audience all applauded, and then the Irish dancers went off. And then four of us went out and did club sets, and it was, you know, it was the wrong crowd, because we were going, hey,
they wanted Hal Roach jokes,
and we were going, you know, when you're riding someone on the back, whatever, and a number of them came around to the stage afterwards to give out to us and say we're a disgrace to Ireland and this is not what they were wanting, and we're going, well, we're not from the Ireland you knew, so it's a different thing, like,
and you had to leave, by the way,
so don't go on about it, right?
Not that, that sounds inconsiderate, but.
I don't think the people who are those who are listening to this podcast, I don't think they're talking they listen to Hal Roach. Does Hal Roach do a podcast? is there an alternative like version of this where, you know, no vegan,
but there is still, if I could, there is still a weird thing where the young Irish do stick together here too,
they do
but they do in the modern way,
yeah, they do,
and they think Australians have no sense of humor.
Do they?
They always say that to me,
god,
and I joke about it at the shows and they all laugh because they all say it.
It's
a real universal thing amongst them. They all think the Aussies have no sense of humor.
God, I find that we have the exact same sense of humor as the Irish.
I know, but no, that's a real thing. Like, it's been said to me like innumerable times. Like, I couldn't count the amount of times people come up and say, they have no sense of humor.
God, really?
They don't get us at all.
We are very full of ourselves. Aren't we? Oh, sure, we're unique.
That I have a joke about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Where I just say, they do have a sense of humor, just not an Irish sense of humor. Is when you meet someone for the first time and you call them a cunt, they get offended. Right? Yeah. It's just a quick joke, right?
Yeah.
But the fact that I have a joke is because it kept being said to me.
Kept said to you.
Yeah.
That's funny. But it is a thing that I found, you know, I think the most, the most self-pathologizing thing about us, the Irish, is that we like to self-pathologize. I found myself on stage doing a speech going, oh, should we love music? And you go, cavemen love music. They like, bang rocks together. Like, oh, we love to laugh. Who doesn't? Everyone laughs.
Irish are great crack, though.
Oh, we are the most crack at all. We have a thing. But
look at that, man. An hour and 17 minutes.
Listen, no one will have got to this
point. I feel guilty.
No one will have got to this point.
They get to the end.
Do you know what? I hate the Irish. Hate them. They're dragging me down.
There's the headline in the song.
Yeah. Right at the very end. We should plunge out of just them going, let me be honest with you, Des. You'll hear me. I'll put down the mic and I'll walk over to the side of the room. Des, I'm just happy to get that off my chest. Finally. Finally.
I've said it. I said it. The fucking language, it was all a calm. It was all a fucking calm.
I was British all along. I was happy to get back to London.
You were.
I got planted
MI5
in Ireland.
Cutbacks.
Put me back in. Like, I found myself on Echo Island going, this has gone too deep.
I'm in too deep. I'm on Echo.
I was signaling furiously with my eyes.
My handler felt like he'd lost me. Eventually, I'd be working for a semi-state party.
Listen, lads, I got permanent pensionable here. I'm not risking this.
Next stop, the Today Show.
Yeah. Oh my God. It's like Donnie Brasco. Like an Irish Donnie Brasco.
Those were the good old days when people watched RT2. Was it RT1 or RT2?
Two. Yeah, yeah. It was probably called Network 2 or N2 or.
Yeah, whatever it was at the time.
God.
Anyway, Dara, thanks a million, man.
Pleasure.
Thank you for your time. So, thanks very much to Dara for being so gracious with his time. Long chat we had. And, this won't really be out in any time to help, but I guess if anyone's in Perth, you can go see Dara's show. I think it's in the next couple of days, but he doesn't need help, really. And but you can tweet him. He's always active on Twitter. And so, yes, that is it for this week's podcast, which is really this month's podcast, the month of March podcast. And anybody has any questions, I'm on Twitter at DesBishop, facebook.com/DesBishop. Snapchat Des Buffer, which is my preferred method of communication nowadays. Or you can Instagram Des Bishop. And I'm going to have Ursula Carlson next, who a lot of you back in Ireland would not have heard of. Great South African comic who actually plies her trade in New Zealand. But she's really blown up here in Australia, this festival. And she's always been one of my favorites. Incredibly funny woman, both on and off the stage. One of those people that you meet and you're immediately in a good mood because she's just great company. So stay tuned for that. Foul Mouth on her too, probably one of our dirtier podcasts, and I'll be happy with that. And David O'Doherty is going to do one finally be able to nail that down, so that'll be in the next week. And stay tuned. We'll definitely have some chats with some people you've never heard of, but we'll have some fun. Maybe I get Lisa Traeger back too. She's over here. She was actually my first interview, but I put it up second. Anyway, I'm blabbering, so if you've never listened to the podcast and it's your first time, do leave an old comment in the iTunes. Give us a nice review. Stitcher too, obviously. I used Stitcher to listen to the S-Town podcast, and I enjoyed that. So anyway, guys, I love you all. Hope you enjoyed that. And we'll talk to you soon. Good night. Oh, by the way, I am promoting everybody else. I'm at the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. Come see my show every night at 7:15 at the Greek Centre, except for a Sunday, which is 6:15, and Monday, which is a night off. And then I'm in Sydney, and then I'm in Perth. So go check that out. How about that? See you later.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.